The pop music you love here on VOA1.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, we tell you about a recently expanded investigation into South Korean adoptions. Later, Dan Novak presents this week's education report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, South Korea's Truth and Reconciliation Commission said last week it will investigate the cases of 237 more South Korean adoptees. The adoptees suspect their family history records were changed to make their adoptions possible in Europe and the United States. The new cases in the investigation involve foreign adoptees in 11 nations. All involve adoptions that took place between 1960 and 1990. More than 370 adoptees from Europe, North America, and Australia registered applications last year demanding that their cases be investigated. The commission said last December it would investigate the first 34 cases. It noted that the records of many adoptees sent to the West had clearly been changed. It said the records falsely described the adoptees as being orphans or not having living parents. It also said the records falsified their identities. The commission said most of the applicants claim their adoptions were based on falsified records meant to make their adoptions possible. Some applicants asked the commission to look into abuses they say they experienced at South Korean orphanages or under the care of their foreign adoptive parents. Of the 271 cases accepted by the commission so far, 141 are those of Danish adoptees. They include members of the Danish-Korean Rights Group. Other cases include 28 U.S. adoptees and 21 Swedish adoptees, officials said. The commission is examining the applications in the order they were registered. Officials have said the group is likely to investigate the remaining 101 cases, too. About 200,000 South Koreans were adopted by parents in Western countries over the past 60 years. They are believed to be the world's largest group of foreign adoptees. Most were placed with white parents in the United States and Europe during the 1970s and 1980s. During that time, South Korea was ruled by back-to-back military dictatorships. The military government focused on policies meant to increase economic growth. The government saw adoption as a way to reduce the number of people to feed, remove the social problem of unmarried mothers, and deepen ties with the democratic West. The military government created special laws aimed at increasing foreign adoptions. Those laws let adoption agencies get around widely accepted child relinquishment practices. To relinquish, in this case, means to give up possession or control of something. Most adoptees were registered by agencies as orphans found abandoned on the streets, even if they had family members who could have been easily identified. That practice has made it hard for South Korean adoptees to know their roots or family history. It was not until 2013 that South Korea's government required foreign adoptions to go through family courts. The change ended a long policy that permitted agencies to control child relinquishments and international adoptions.
Lawmakers in several U.S. states have passed limits on discussions of race, gender, and sexuality in classrooms. Some students say the measures targeting parts of their identity have made them feel less welcome in American schools. The first time Tennessee student Harmony Kennedy remembered experiencing racism was in elementary school. On a playground, a girl picked up a leaf and said she wanted to clean the dirt from Harmony's skin. In 2021, Tennessee started passing legislation that could limit the discussion and teaching of Black history, gender identity, and race in the classroom. To Harmony, the law's possible effects are crushing. When I heard they were removing African American history, banning LGBTQ, I almost started crying, said Harmony, who is 16. LGBTQ is short for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer. Conservative leaders in some states have strongly pushed for the new restrictions. Those lawmakers say the restrictions are necessary to fight against liberal ideas in schools. Activists and school boards have pushed for such moves, too. They say teachers need more oversight to make sure learning materials are appropriate. Books have been removed from some school libraries. Some schools have continued to call transgender students by the name they had before they changed to a different gender. Some teachers are worried of breaking new rules. As a result, they have avoided discussions related to race, gender, and other divisive issues.
Leo Burchell goes to a school outside Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In late 2020, during the pandemic school closures, he started using different pronouns. He started wearing different clothes. He cut his hair shorter, too. The changes, he said, felt right. First, he asked teachers to use they-them pronouns instead of she-her. Then he asked that they use he-him pronouns when talking to him. I changed my name to Leo, and for a while it was tough, he said. I told the people close to me, but I wasn't ready to come out to everybody yet. Leo's school is part of the Central Bucks School District. Over the last year, the board has barred employees from using students' chosen names or pronouns without parental permission. The board passed what it called a neutrality policy. The policy is meant to prevent social and political advocacy in classrooms. But opponents say the measure targets LGBTQ students. One man told the school board in a meeting that transgender people presented a risk of violence in bathrooms. Leo expected another adult in the room to intervene in what felt to him like hate speech, but no one did. So at the next board meeting, Leo spoke up, attacking students based on who they are or who they love is wrong, he said. Leo has spoken up at other meetings since then. Leo said he worries about what school will be like for younger transgender students. It really just breaks my heart to know that some of my friends, you know, might not want to go to school anymore, he said.
In Harmony's freshman year English class, a boy started playing with his face mask and joked, "I can't breathe," just like George Floyd, Harmony remembered. Floyd, a black man, was murdered in 2020 by a policeman in Minnesota. His death led to nationwide and worldwide protests. Harmony told her teacher, who said she was sorry it happened, but there was not much she could do. Harmony said the incident was a reminder of why it is important to teach a full version of American history. A law passed by Tennessee in 2021 banned schools from teaching several ideas on race and racism. Because of the law, many teachers now avoid discussions related to race. After the incident, Harmony decided to join the Forward Club. The group works to support cultural and racial inclusion at her mostly white high school. The club's members come from diverse backgrounds. At times, students who speak out against new policies have been targeted. In Williamson County, Tennessee, where Harmony goes to school, a political action committee, or PAC, accused another high school's black student union of promoting segregation. The PAC posted the time and place of the student group's meeting on social media. Elsewhere, transgender students who have spoken up about bullying have faced insults on social media.
Harmony said she has had to go outside of school to learn about black culture and history. Her experience in high school has led her to want to attend a historically black college. Harmony said she wants to be able to go to school like any other teenager and focus on learning. But she said she will continue to speak out for what she believes in. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Dan Novak.
Novak is here now to talk more about this week's education report. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
Your story centered on a transgender student named Leo. He transitioned from female to male and changed his pronouns to he, him. Could you explain what a pronoun is for our listeners that may not know?
Yes, a pronoun is a word we use instead of a noun. For example, instead of calling me Dan every time you speak about me, you can use him or he. It is another pronoun used to describe a thing.
A rule passed by Leo's school district in Pennsylvania prevents school employees from using students' chosen names or pronouns without parental permission. Why is this a sensitive issue for some trans students?
I obviously can't speak for all trans students or trans people, but when many kids come out as trans, they do so first at school with their friends and teachers. They may not feel comfortable or even safe coming out to their family. About 20-40% of homeless teens are gay or trans, says the Center for American Progress. For trans people, having their preferred pronouns used is essential to who they are as a person. So, Leo and others argue that having trans kids get parental permission before teachers could use their preferred pronouns could be harmful.
It seems like this may just be the beginning of the debate about these issues. Thanks again for coming on the show today, Dan.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Soon after his presidency began, there was an attempt on his life. A gunman shot President Reagan in March 1981. Doctors removed the bullet. He rested, regained his strength, and returned to the White House in 12 days. The new president wanted to reduce the size of the federal government. He and other conservative Republicans wanted less government interference in the lives of Americans. President Reagan won congressional approval for his plan to reduce income tax rates. Many Americans welcomed the plan. Others were concerned about its effects on the national debt. They saw taxes go down while defense spending went up. To save money, the Reagan administration decided to cut spending for some social programs. This pleased conservatives. Liberals, however, said it limited poor people's chances for good housing, healthcare, and education. President Reagan also had to make decisions about using military force in other countries. In 1983, he sent Marines to Lebanon. They joined other peacekeeping troops to help stop fighting among competing groups. On October 23rd, a truck carrying explosives bombed Marine housing at Beirut International Airport.
There was nothing in its appearance to suggest it was any different than the trucks or cars that were normally seen on and around the airport. But this one was different. At the wheel was a young man on a suicide mission. The truck carried some 2,000 pounds of explosives. But there was no way our Marine guards could know this. Their first warning that something was wrong came when the truck crashed through a series of barriers. The guards opened fire, but it was too late. The truck smashed through the doors of the headquarters building in which our Marines were sleeping and instantly exploded.
241 Americans were killed. Two days later, Marines led an invasion of the Caribbean island nation of Grenada. Communist forces were rebelling against the government there. Cuban soldiers were guarding the streets. President Reagan said he feared for the safety of American students at a medical school in Grenada. He sent the Marines to get them out safely. The Marines quickly defeated the communist forces. Many Americans were pleased. Others were angry. They said Grenada was invaded only to make people forget about what happened in Lebanon. The next year, 1984, was a presidential election year. It looked like no one could stop President Reagan. His warm way with people had made him hugely popular. He gained support with the military victory in Grenada, and by the time the campaign started, inflation was under control. The Republican Party renominated Ronald Reagan for president and George Bush for vice president. There were several candidates for the Democratic Party's nomination. One was the first African American to seek the presidency, Jesse Jackson. He was a Protestant clergyman and a longtime human rights activist. The candidate who finally won the nomination was Walter Mondale. He had been a senator and had served as vice president under President Jimmy Carter. The vice presidential candidate was Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro. It was the first time a major party in the United States had nominated a woman for national office.
Tonight, the daughter of working Americans tells all Americans that the future is within our reach if we're willing to reach for it.
One issue in the election campaign was taxes. Political candidates often try to avoid talking about taxes with voters. But former Vice President Mondale did talk about the issue. He said taxes would have to be raised to pay for new government programs.
The American people will have to pay Mr. Reagan's bills. The budget will be squeezed. Taxes will go up. And anyone who says they won't is not telling the truth to the American people.
This was a serious political mistake. President Reagan gained even more support as a result. The two candidates agreed to debate on television. During one debate, President Reagan looked old and tired. He did not seem sure of his answers. Yet his popularity was not damaged. On Election Day, he won 59% of the popular vote. On Inauguration Day, the weather was bitterly cold in Washington. All inaugural activities, including the swearing-in ceremony, were held inside. President Reagan's first term began with an attempt on his life. 6 months after his second term began, he faced another threat. Doctors discovered and removed a large growth from his colon. The growth was cancerous. The president was 74 years old. Yet once again, he quickly regained his strength and returned to work. For years, the United States had accused Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi of supporting international terrorist groups. It said he provided them with weapons and a safe place for their headquarters. In January 1986, the United States announced economic actions against Libya. Then it began military training exercises near the Libyan coast. Libya said the Americans were violating its territory and fired missiles at them. The Americans fired back, sinking two ships. On April 5th, a bomb destroyed a dance club in West Berlin. An American soldier and another person were killed. The United States said Libya was responsible. President Reagan ordered a bombing raid on the Libyan cities of Tripoli and Benghazi. Muammar Gaddafi escaped unharmed, but said his adopted daughter was killed. Some Americans said the raid was cruel. Others praised it. President Reagan said the United States did what it had to do. The president also wanted to intervene in Nicaragua. about 15,000 rebel troops, called Contras, were fighting the country's communist government. President Reagan asked for military aid for the Contras. Congress rejected the request. In fact, it banned all aid to the Contras. At that same time, Muslim extremists in Lebanon seized several Americans. The Reagan administration looked for ways to gain the release of the hostages. It decided to sell missiles and missile parts to Iran in exchange for Iran's help. After the sale, Iran told the extremists in Lebanon to release a few American hostages. Not long after, serious charges became public. Reports said that money from the sale of arms to Iran was used to aid the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Several members of the Reagan administration resigned. It appeared that some had violated the law. President Reagan said he regretted what had happened, but he said he had not known about it. Investigations and court trials of those involved continued into the 1990s. Several people were found guilty of illegal activities or of lying to Congress. No one went to jail. Most Americans did not blame the president for the actions of others in his administration. They still supported him and his policies. They especially supported his efforts to deal with the Soviet Union. At the beginning of his first term, President Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire. To protect the United States against the Soviets, he increased military spending to the highest level in American history. Then, in 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev became the leader of the Soviet Union. Reagan and Gorbachev held four summit meetings in Geneva, Switzerland, Reykjavik, Iceland, Washington, and Moscow. Each leader agreed to destroy hundreds of nuclear missiles. President Reagan also urged General Secretary Gorbachev to become more democratic. He spoke about the Berlin Wall, which communists had built to prevent citizens from crossing between East and West Berlin.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
About this time, a new sense of glasnost, or openness, was beginning in the Soviet Union. It was also a time of perestroika, or restructuring. The American economy grew rapidly during Ronald Reagan's presidency, but at the end of his second term, many Americans were concerned by what he left behind. Increased military spending, together with tax cuts, had made the national debt huge. The United States owed thousands of millions of dollars. The debt would be a political issue for presidents to come. Yet Ronald Reagan will be remembered as one of America's most popular presidents. Above his burial place at the Reagan Library in California are these words, which speak to Reagan's belief in humanity. I know in my heart that man is good, that what is right will always eventually triumph, and there is purpose and worth to each and every life.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.